What specifically would you do to bring manufacturing jobs back to Detroit and to train the residents here to do those jobs?
The way you bring manufacturing back to America is, number one, you lift the regulations. As president, I will repeal Obamacare, the biggest job killer in America.
In 1997, Michael Wayne Haley was arrested after stealing a calculator from Walmart. This was a crime that merited a maximum 2-year prison term, but prosecutors incorrectly applied a habitual offender law. Neither the judge nor the defense lawyer caught the error, and Haley was sentenced to 16 years. Eventually, the mistake came to light, and Haley tried to fix it. The Solicitor General of Texas at that time, instead of letting Haley go for time served, decided to take the case all the way to the Supreme Court in order to try to get Haley to serve the full 16 years. Now remember, this was a calculator from Walmart. Think about now, I understand it all, stealing is wrong. But imagine how ubiquitous calculators are now. You can go get an old cell phone, find an old cell phone on the street, and it's gonna have a calculator in it. But back then, not so much. But even still, stealing is stealing. So the case goes to the Supreme Court, and some of the justices were skeptical. Quote, "Is there some rule that you can't confess error in your state?" Justice Anthony Kennedy asked. The court system did finally let Haley out of prison, but after 6 years. So who is the Solicitor General? Or was the Solicitor General in Texas at the time? That man's name is Ted Cruz. And he is now running for president and running very strongly among evangelical voters. But in his career and public presentation, Cruz, quoting from the New York Times now, is a stranger to what most of us would generally be considered Christian values, such as humility, mercy, compassion, and grace. In the opening clip right there, you heard him say, "We are going to get rid of Obamacare. We're going to kill Obamacare because Obamacare is clearly a job killer. Millions of jobs have been created since President Obama has become president. The unemployment rate is now under 5%. Do we call that a job killer? But it doesn't matter. You have a dishonest man running for president. Now, I understand that Trump is at the top of the ticket, and very quickly here, Trump may secure the nomination. But let us not forget, there is another man in the race for the GOP nomination, and he too is very, very dangerous. Folks look at Trump and they say, oh, how awful would it be if he became president because he's a fascist. And that's true. He is a fascist. But Cruz is a craven theocrat. Quoting again from the New York Times here, Cruz's behavior in the Haley case is almost the dictionary definition of Pharisaism, an overzealous application of the letter of the law in a way that violates the spirit of the law as well as fairness and mercy. Now remember, mercy and compassion, very Christian values, or they're supposed to be. Traditionally, candidates who have attracted strong evangelical support have in part emphasized the need to lend a helping hand to the economically stressed and the least fortunate among us. With Ted Cruz, his speeches are marked by what you might call pagan brutalism. There's not a hint of compassion, gentleness, and mercy. Instead, his speeches are marked by a long list of enemies that he vows to crush, shred, destroy, and bomb. When he is speaking in a church, the contrast between the setting and the emotional tone he sets is jarring.
You know, 2016 is going to be an incredible year. 2016 is going to be the last year of the Obama presidency. 2016 is going to be the last year before Hillary retires permanently to Chappaqua. 2016 is going to be the last year that we have Obamacare. 2016 is going to be the last year until we abolish the IRS. And 2016 is going to be the last year until we utterly destroy ISIS and defeat radical Islamic terrorism.
That was Ted Cruz appearing on Fox News on New Year's Eve. And even then they said, hey, Mr. Cruz, Senator Cruz, what are you looking forward to in the upcoming year? And what does he do? He starts rattling off a kill list. I can't wait to kill this. I can't wait to destroy that. I can't wait to take people's access to healthcare away. Now remember, Obamacare, it's access to healthcare. It's not free. It's not government healthcare. It's access. It increases people's access to our overpriced healthcare system. But even still, it's better than what we had before. Quoting from the New York Times again, as the Republican strategist Kurt Anderson observed in Politico, there's no variation in Cruz's rhetorical tone, as is the wont of inauthentic speakers, especially is described as a maximum existential threat. Everything is a threat. The fact is, this apocalyptic diagnosis is ridiculous. The Obama administration has done things people like me, a progressive, strongly disagree with. But America is in better economic shape right now than it has been at any other time. Crime is down. Abortion rates are down. 14 million people now have jobs just in the last 5 years. Obama has championed a liberal agenda, but he hasn't made the country unrecognizable, as you'll hear conservatives say out on the campaign trail. Federal spending accounted for 20.3% of gross domestic product. In 2015, it counted for 20.9%. It has not gone up. And let me say this, Obamacare. And I can't believe after all this time, I'm still having to bring this up. I'm still having to talk about this. I'm still having to defend this. Obamacare. Obamacare helped damn near everybody. Yes, 9 out of 10 people now have access to healthcare. Access. So 1 out of 10 still don't. Hey, it's an imperfect system, but it's better than what we had before. There's a gentleman that I know out in Pennsylvania. I won't mention his name, but I feel okay telling the story because he doesn't listen to the show. He recently went on his Facebook page and began railing against Obama. Now, he's not a Republican. He himself is a progressive too. But he doesn't have a full-time job and decided that because he's young, he doesn't want to buy into the Obamacare system. Well, this tax year, he's being nailed with a tax penalty. And he went off on his Facebook page and I says, look at you using the internet created by the government to rail against the federal government. He says to me, why do I have to pay? Why should I have to pay? If I don't want to have health care, I shouldn't have to have health care. But here's the thing. We all have bodies. Those bodies are imperfect and susceptible to a lot of things. At some point, everybody's going to need health care of some sort, access to it. He says, no, I won't. I said, you're going to be old someday. Fine, Medicare. He's paying for Medicare right now through his taxes on his paycheck. He'll take that someday. But he doesn't want to have to pay for healthcare now because he sees it as too expensive. He says, I don't need it. And I said, everybody should be paying into the system because we all use the system. And eventually, even if you're not using it now, you eventually will. It didn't take more than 2 weeks. He was involved in an accident. He's okay, but he ended up in the emergency room. And he ended up in the emergency room without healthcare. I said nothing. It said itself. There you are. And now you're going to be nailed with a gigantic bill. See, we all use it eventually. Most of us benefited from Obamacare. My insurance stayed essentially the same. I know there are some benefits. I can't be dropped if I get sick now, and those things are great. But most of us benefit regardless of party. And I say this for this good reason. There's a gentleman who recently introduced President Obama at one of the speeches that the president gave. And he got up in front of everybody, and I'll play the clip for you here. And he says, hey, I did not vote for this man. I worked tirelessly against this man, referring to President Obama. But the Affordable Care Act saved my life.
The Affordable Care Act saved my life. I want to repeat that. The Affordable Care Act saved my life. To be clear, I have never voted for President Obama, ever. I am a Republican who cursed his name who falsely accused him, and someone who zealously worked to ensure that he would never be my president. But thanks to his fortitude, thanks to his unwavering vision of mercy, even towards me, this chump gets a second shot at life.
Worked hard against this president. Used a lot of fear-based arguments that were not at all rooted in fact. And yet, he gets another chance. And this is why it's important. Humility, mercy, compassion, and grace. Those Christian values, they don't make much of an appearance in the Republican Party. They most certainly don't in Republican policy, and they definitely don't in Republican speeches. Okay, maybe that's not fair. Sometimes they do, but if you elect a Republican, they will cut everything that helps you. The reason it's important to elect somebody that sees all of us as people, sees all of us as a society, sees all of us as we are in this together, is not just for economic reasons. Now, if you've got lots of money, you're going to be fine. You've got lots of money, you don't even need insurance. You can just go pay cash for your health care. But not all of us are that fortunate. And there are studies that come out every year that say the more poor you are, the less likely you are to live a long life. The more money you have, the more likely you are to live a long life. Now, remember, we're talking about conservatives, the family, pro-family party, the pro-life party. And yet, their policies are cutting years off of people's lives. This also from the New York Times. Experts have long known that rich people generally live longer than poor people. And poor people are losing ground, not only in income, but also in years of life. The most basic measurement of well-being. In the early 70s, a 60-year-old man in the top half of the earnings ladder could expect to live 1.2 years longer than a man of the same age on the bottom half. Okay, 1.2 years. According to an analysis by the Social Security Administration. Fast forward to 2001 and he could expect to live 5.8 years longer than his poorer counterpart. New research, though, recently released by economists at the Brookings Institution found that for men born in 1920, there was a 6-year difference in life expectancy between the top 10% of earners and the bottom 10%. For men born in 1950, that difference has doubled to 14 years. For women, the gap grew to 13 years from 4.7 years. And both Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary Hillary Clinton have expressed concern over shortening lifespans for Americans. Overall, according to the Brookings study, life expectancy for the bottom 10% of wage earners improved by just 3% for men born in 1950 compared to those born in 1920. For the top 10%, though, it jumped by about 28%. The researchers used a common measure, life expectancy at age 50, and included data from 84 to 2012. I'm sorry if this is getting a little wonky. I'm trying to spell it out as best I can. It's hard to point to one overriding cause. In recent years, though, smoking has been one of the things that you've been able to point to and say, hey, if you don't do this, you will live longer. When you talk about actuarials, and I love the actuarial sciences. I considered being an actuary for a long time. It is boring, nose in the books, but you work for insurance companies figuring out how long people may potentially live based on their health, their lifestyle choices, things of that nature. And if there's two things that the actuarial sciences will point out extend your life more than just about anything else that you can do, they are not smoking or smoking, you know, that'll cut your life, wearing a seatbelt. Those two things will dramatically increase your life. From the Brookings study, we see that also having the means will also help you live longer. And in a country where we're seeing wages get cut, Oregon just raised their minimum wage to $14.75 an hour, but it's going to be spanned over 6 years. Well, a lot of good that's going to do for people that can't afford their rent right now. And even once it gets up to that point, people still aren't going to be able to afford their rent. They're still not going to be able to afford to be independent. In Seattle, they raised it to $15 an hour. And the conservatives are outraged. They're so mad about this. Oh, how dare you?
What about the small businesses? You're going to kill jobs.
Here's the thing. People cannot afford to live. They're working full time. There's not a place in the entire United States right now where you can work full time and afford an apartment. Excuse me. And earn the minimum wage. I got to throw that in there. Holy hell.
Melvin, how are other people surviving?
Sorry. The minimum wage in any given state. If you work for the minimum wage in any state.
Now, come on, Melvin. That's a starting wage. That's what they pay to the teenagers.
No, it's not true. It's not true. There are a lot of families that where the breadwinners only make minimum wage. And you'll have two parents working and it still isn't cutting it. Take, for example, two parents making $7.25 an hour. So, and by the way, they're gone, you know, collectively 16 hours from the house. That's 16 hours gone. 16 hours, $7.25 an hour, or say 8 hours at $14.50 an hour. And that's still not enough to make it. They're probably still going to end up in the bread lines. They're probably still going to end up at the food bank. They're probably still going to end up on public assistance. And that's the other thing. If you've got a concern that the government spends way too much money, you should want these businesses to start paying for their employees to be able to afford things like food and healthcare. Because when they don't, when the rich don't pay fair wages, because remember, it's a job killer to pay people a wage that can keep them alive. You and I get to pick up the tab. Remember that. Finishing up the article here, limited access to healthcare accounts for surprisingly few premature deaths in America. But it's an open question still whether President Obama's healthcare law, which has sharply reduced the number of Americans without health insurance since 2014, will help ease the disparity. The growing longevity gap means that benefits like Social Security are paid out even more disproportionately to the better off because they are around for more years to collect the money. So think about that. They get to live a longer life because they have more money. And they get to collect more of the Social Security at the end of their life because they live longer. One more thing that just helps the rich. Poor health outcomes for low-income Americans have dragged the United States down to some of the lowest rankings of life expectancy among rich countries. The Social Security Administration's found, for example, that life expectancy for the wealthiest American men at age 60 was just below the rates in Iceland and Japan, two countries where people live the longest. Americans in the bottom quarter of the wage scale have, however, ranked much further down, one notch above Poland and the Czech Republic. But we're being told, if you just deregulate, if you keep people's wages low, if you just strip out all of the EPA regulations, if you just strip all the safety regulations, if you just let the invisible hand of the free market do what it's supposed to do, if you just give everything to the people at the very, very freaking top, then everything will be better for everybody. And eventually, it will trickle down. So, Joe Scarborough, who is now a host on MSNBC, the morning host. He does a show in the morning with Mika Brzezinski. I don't watch the show, but I watch a lot of the clips that land online because Joe, as of late, has been spitting a bit more truth than I'm used to now. Joe is a Republican, any good Republican at that. He was a Republican when he served in Congress. He's a Republican on the air now. I remember when, back in 2012... When I think it was Mitt Romney said something particularly dumb in an audio clip that they played, and he took his two hands and he just buried his head in his hands and he just went, oh no, watching. This is a man watching his party die. This is a man watching his party go absolutely insane. And now this year, initially he was on the Trump train. And there's another clip floating around out there of him and Mika Brzezinski talking with Trump when they thought the mic wasn't hot. And they were talking about, yeah, we're going to ask you this question, not ask you that question. We'll go easy on you, this and that. And it looks like, uh-oh, someone's in the tank for this guy. And I think what it really was Joe just being a good Republican. But then the whole Klan thing happened. We played that clip on last week's show or the week before. Excuse me. I know I did two shows on hate. And when the Klan thing happened, Joe said, oh, you know what? That is just unforgivable. And recently, Joe went on the air and said, you know what? The American people have had it. The jig is up. Everybody has realized the trickle-down economics. And this was Ronald Reagan's baby. Trickle-down economics does not work.
The problem with the Republican Party over the past 30 years is they haven't, and I'll say we haven't, developed a message that appeals to the working class Americans economically in a way that how Donald Trump's does. I mean, you look at the fact we talk about cutting capital gains taxes. That 10,000 people that are in the crowd cheering for Donald Trump, they are never going to get a capital gains cut because it doesn't apply. We talk about getting rid of the death tax. The death tax is not going to impact the 10,000 people in the crowd for Donald Trump. We talk about how great free trade deals are. Those free trade deals never trickle down to those 10,000 people in Donald Trump's
crowd. Sounds like Bernie Sanders.
Guess what? Herein lies the problem with the Republican Party. It never trickles down. Those people in Trump's crowds, those are all the ones that lost the jobs when they get moved to Mexico and elsewhere. The Republican donor class were the ones that got rich off of it because their capital moved overseas and they made higher profits.
And
you can say
the
same with national security.
It never trickles down, he says. Hey, you sound like Bernie Sanders. No. Just listen to me. Yeah, you do. And you know why you sound like Bernie Sanders? Because Bernie Sanders is right. So these trade deals and trickle-down economics has pushed wages down, pushed access to everything that we as Americans need, healthcare, food, and all these other things, water, access to clean water. It's pushed all of those things down. And our trade deals have shipped more and more of our jobs overseas. And this, because these trade deals are in place. And the president is trying to promote another trade deal that will strip us of even more jobs. Now, I'm with President Obama. Been with him for a long time. You know what I mean. And by and large, I've been happy with him as president. But I don't want the TPP to pass. The TPP is not good for anybody. Not Democrats, not Republicans. And it escapes me in a large way why he is promoting it. But he is. These trade deals have shipped our jobs overseas en masse. And even now, they're still shipping our jobs overseas. Hillary Clinton was on with Rachel Maddow recently. And Rachel maybe didn't catch it or maybe didn't hear it the same way I heard it. But Rachel says to Secretary Clinton, NAFTA shipped jobs overseas. We did not get the jobs that we were promised from these trade deals. And we've lost a lot of jobs because of them. What say you? And then the first thing out of Secretary Clinton's mouth was, of course we did. And then she goes on to point out why she would renegotiate them and why they're bad. Now, wait a minute. Of course we did. What do you mean, of course we did? Saying, of course we did, says, yeah, that's what we anticipated. We anticipated losing a crap ton of jobs. Of course. So Rachel didn't catch it, or just didn't see it as a big deal. And I didn't cut the clip for you. It made me sick. And I really didn't want to pull it. But I can tell you, the first thing she opened with was, of course. So, as I was saying, jobs still being shipped overseas. I deliver plumbing, heating, HVAC stuff. And one of the brands that we deal with sometimes is a brand called Carrier. Now, Carrier has a manufacturing and distribution plant here in the United States of America. But recently, they decided, thanks to our trade deals, which give you a tax break, by the way, if you ship your job overseas, you get a tax break, or just ship it outside of the country. And Carrier has decided that they're going to send their factory to Mexico. Have you, and I'm talking to you, the listener, have you ever heard the sound of 1,400 people losing their jobs in one fell swoop? In a country, by the way, that has created 14 million jobs in the last 5 years. You are now going to hear 1,400 people lose their jobs in one fell swoop.
It became clear that the best way to stay competitive and protect the business for long term is to move production from our facility in Indianapolis to Monterrey, Mexico. Listen, I've got information that's important to share as a part of the transition. If we could go ahead. If you don't want to hear it, other people do. So let's quiet down. Thank you very much. We also intend to relocate the distribution center from Indianapolis as well. Relocating our operations to Monterrey will allow us to maintain high levels of product quality at competitive prices and continue to serve the extremely price-sensitive marketplace. I want to be clear, this is strictly a business decision. Once again, let's please get more information to share. And by no means a reflection of the performance of this facility or any individual within it. It is important that you understand that there will be no impact on jobs today. In fact, the first transition would not take place until the middle of 2017.
It is not a reflection of anybody within this company. It is not a reflection of your performance. Oh, good! Now everybody feels better. We will go home, we will tell our loved ones that we lost our jobs because this is an incredibly price-sensitive market. I use the word protectionism all the time, and I'm a big believer in it. There is a case to be made for it. We can make these things here in America. We have the technology. We have the people. We have the smarts. We've got folks that want to work. We can do it here. But the CEO may be able to make his pay go from $10 million a year to $15 or $20 million a year. They're not going to Mexico because they're going to pay those people a living wage. Oh, no! And when conservatives here in America argue that we need to keep wages low if we want to keep jobs here, it doesn't pass the smell test. Because the CEOs of these companies are making $300, $400, $500, sometimes 1,000 times or more than their lowest hourly paid worker is getting. You know, say the janitor makes $7.25 an hour. Then the CEO makes 1,000 times that, or he makes 500 times that. So can we not simply pay the CEO, who, by the way, if he's shipping those jobs overseas, really isn't that great of a CEO? Can we not pay him 15, 20, 30 times what the lowest paid worker makes and pay the people at the bottom a little bit better? And by the way, and stop compensating them with stock. Because when you compensate these CEOs with stock or compensate them with what they call performance-based pay, which is they say, okay, you can pay, so the tax law says you can pay your CEO $1 million an hour, but you can give him whatever you want in performance-based pay. So you go, if you can only pay him $1 million an hour, $1 million a year, how the hell they get away with paying him $50, $60, $70, $80, $100 million a year? Performance-based pay. And it's given to them as a bonus. And a lot of the times it's given to them as stock options, which then gives an incentive to the CEO to do whatever he can to make sure the stock prices go up. Shipping these jobs for Carrier to Mexico, paying those people $2 an hour, not having to pay America's exorbitant health costs, is going to save them quite a bit of money. And that money isn't going to be passed on to you, the consumer of Carrier products. What that is instead going to do is it's just going to make them way richer. And they're going to be exploiting this human tragedy that happens in so many other countries where people are working for slave wages. So that clip right there, it came from a YouTube video. It was incredibly hard to watch. I can't even imagine how the hearts broke in that audience. And it was also really, really hard to edit it. Because as you can imagine, when those folks lost their jobs, they were not real happy. As a matter of fact, there were F-bombs flying everywhere. And I had to meticulously go through that clip, but I want to point this out to you just to show you the passion was there, was very much there. It's very heartbreaking to watch and very heartbreaking to hear, but this is what's happening as a result of our trade deals. There were F-bombs flying everywhere, and I meticulously went through that clip and cut them all out. But bloody hell, this is not what we should be dealing with in America. We're not better off because we're exploiting slavery in other countries where they don't care about their people. And the conservative argument that if all we do is quit giving a crap about our people, right? We quit giving them access to healthcare, quit giving them a living wage, everything is going to be better for everybody. Trickle down is a lie. It has not worked for anybody. We on the bottom are not seeing our wages go up. But CEOs, the super rich, Wall Street, they are. One of the best measurements I was able to find of how much better the wealthy are doing than the rest of us. And remember, we've got to make some cuts because they just need a little bit more. Yeah, I understand they have it all, but they need just a little bit more. This from Bloomberg Business by Joyce Koh and Rachel Chang. Pay $65 million for the G650 or the G650ER personal jets, and your wait to board them could be as long as 2 years. This from the headline, why you'll have to wait years before getting your Gulfstream personal jet. Scott Neal, Gulfstream's Senior Vice President of Worldwide Sales and Marketing, said in a Bloomberg television interview at the Singapore Air Show that the G650R has taken market share at the top end of the market. Savannah, Georgia-based Gulfstream, is seeing such strong demand for its personal jets from corporations and chief executives, the a-holes that are ripping us off, that the General Dynamics Corp unit is looking to increase production of the planes in the G650 family. Millionaires in search of new toys are set to fuel a four-fold jump in Asia's share of private jet sales in the next 5 years, according to a 2013 forecast by aviation consultant Jet Solution International Services Limited. Asians may own as much as 20% of the global luxury jet fleet by 2017, as economic growth spawns new millionaires. Southeast Asia will create the next wave of demand for private aircraft, benefiting Gulfstream, Embraer SA, and Textron Inc., Cessna, the aviation consultant, said. So there is now a two-year wait if you want to buy a private jet. No, hold on.
Melvin, these guys have to wait 2 years to get their personal jet, to get a private plane, to own a private plane that seats about 10, 12 people, that costs millions of dollars. Simply because even when the plane is just sitting on the ground, it's still costing you hundreds of thousands of dollars. These poor CEOs, not just in America, but in Asia and in some of the other countries that are exploiting their workforce, they now have to wait 2 years. And Melvin, who the bloody hell do you think you are that you get to complain that you and your people don't have enough food and don't have enough water, and don't have access to healthcare? Did you not hear that there's a two-year private wait for private planes? Have you no soul, Melvin?
The thing that annoys me the most about the way we discuss economics and government policy is the term free stuff. And even Democrats use it. Free stuff. Everybody just wants free stuff. No. We don't want free stuff. We would like our tax dollars to go towards something that is actually going to benefit us, something that we actually need, something that we will get something out of, something that we can use. It's not free. We're going to pay for it. When Senator Sanders talks about tuition-free college, he's simply saying there is a way to strip money out of the top where they clearly don't need it because they're collecting private jets. To take money out of the top, put it into the bottom where it will do some good, where it will be spent in society, where it will have a multiplier effect, and where it will help everybody. Even the rich will be better off once the rest of us have a little bit more money, and we won't have to suffer. But the term free stuff is used over and over and over again, and it's an attack on all of us when they say that. It's not free. Nothing is free. We know that it's not free. We're just saying that there should be a change in government policy. So I was listening to John Kasich give a speech at one of his rallies on CNN. And the big applause line for John Kasich was, we're going to reform welfare. We're going to do something about welfare because something needs to be done. He says, and I'm doing it from memory here, so it's not an exact quote, so I won't say quote. He says, I understand compassion. We should be compassionate. We should be providing for our fellow man, but we have to find a way for them to start providing for themselves. And as Lee Atwater pointed out to us, when that kind of language is used, and we know this about the Republican Party now because they've told us in so many words that when they hear things like that, they think black. Never mind the fact that most people collecting welfare, food stamps, are actually white. When they hear that kind of language, it becomes a big fat applause line because they hear black. That this is economically is going to hurt black people worse than it's going to hurt white people. The food stamp program is a part of the agriculture program. And for the fiscal year 2015, 1% of federal spending went to agriculture spending, which, like I said, includes food stamps. 1%. So what you're saying to me is if I spit in the ocean, it's going to cause sea levels to rise. It doesn't make any sense. It's 1%. Now, there is a part of the budget where I can see some reform being needed, but we don't talk about that. More than 50% of the federal budget, somewhere between 53 and 54% of the federal budget went to one department last year. One department. And it wasn't the welfare department. It went to defense. Now, we're not any safer. We're not any better off. As a matter of fact, we're creating more enemies around the world with our constant American Empire project. And it's just costing us more and more money. But you want that applause line and you're running for president, you say black, economics, welfare, black.
None of these people are speaking out on the basis of economic policy, foreign policy. None of these things affect whether life in this country will be wonderful because of opportunity. All of this is related to what you're going to do for blacks, what you're going to do for us. Those are the words that come out. But what they really mean is what you're going to do for me, how much I'm going to get paid, what I'm going to get out this deal. CNN's Mark Lamont Hill says, quote, Bernie Sanders has to put himself in a position where black voters see him as the conscience choice, see him as the one who reflects their sensibilities. He has not done that purely by talking economics. You can't talk economics. We're talking about black folk here. Black folk don't need to hear no economics.
That's conservative talk show host Michael Berry doing his best impression of black people asking, what are you going to do for me because I'm black? So we've discussed the racial problem on the right, and with respect to the way that they're running for president, with the respect to the way that Cruz is running for president and Donald Trump is running for president, and one of those two guys is going to be the nominee. It's very likely Trump, but I don't want people to feel nice and relaxed and at ease in your comfy chairs at home if Cruz becomes the nominee, because he's really not any better. He is a theocrat. This kind of racism in 2016 is now being thrown around on the right with reckless abandon, without so much as even a second thought about what it's doing to conservative listeners, what it's doing to, I mean, the conservative audience as a whole, what it's doing to black people. Did you know there's a story recently in the news where two rival basketball teams, you know, are playing in a high school gym, and there are some minorities, dark-skinned minorities on one of the teams. And the white opponents from the other team are chanting at them, Trump is going to deport you. Trump is going to deport you. Racist bullying in the year 2016. I can't even effing believe I have to say this. It's 2016. When I saw the movie Rosewood a number of years back, it was a time, and if you haven't seen it, a white woman tells a lie. She says she's cheating on her husband. And she says that she is raped. She was raped by a local black man. And the entire town goes crazy and begins lynching black people from here to forever. I mean, they just kill many black people as they can. And I go, wow, it's so great that we don't live in that kind of a society anymore, where that kind of thing happens freely and openly. Now, by the end of the movie, the woman is caught. She says, I lied. I wasn't raped. And this is after about a dozen black people are killed, strangled, lynched, beaten, shot. And after all these people, and then she says, didn't happen. So what does she get? She gets beaten up by her husband, the guy she was cheating on. But at the end of that movie, I said, wow, it's great it doesn't happen anymore, that we don't treat black people like that anymore. And I was mentioning this to my beautiful bride. And I said, I can't believe how much of this racism has come roaring back in the year 2016. I said, but hey, at least we're not killing them, openly lynching black people like they were back then. And she says, actually, we are. Look at all the police killings. And I said, holy hell. She's right. It really is all back now. And people are very dismissive of the Black Lives Matter movement. And the reason it is what it is because black people are being killed without good reason, without just cause. And their families are not getting answers. And the country's just turning its head the other way and just pretending that it isn't happening. And that's awful. I've been saying that the Republican Party is on its deathbed right now. What you are hearing is the death rattle of the Republican Party. They're going to go away after this year. Now, I was watching Rachel Maddow recently. She said, no, it's more than likely not the case. And I said, well, no. To me, in my head, I said, no, because what you've been watching with Reagan and with George Bush and with, and George W. Bush and, on to... I think one of the reasons Mitt Romney didn't get elected is because he wasn't a big enough moron. And now they want Trump to be their president. You've watched this natural de-evolution in the party. And now it's come to this. And this is where the party dies. But not everybody wants that to happen. There are some folks who are conservative who are willing to recognize that it's happening, but also willing to say that this should not be happening the way it is. And the Republican Party will not be able to stand as an all-white party. They're running with a ton of racism in the presidential election right now. But as it was pointed out by one of the more fair conservatives, Michael Medved, there's no future for the Republicans as an all-white party.
I don't believe that our party, which after all is the party of Lincoln and Reagan, should be welcoming someone who spews the kind of hatred that Donald Trump does. I am concerned about the message for the future because one of the things I've been talking about for 20 years in Republican circles is that we have no future as an all-white party. It cannot continue that way. Mitt Romney won 60% of the white vote in 2012 and lost the election because he did so poorly among Latinos and Asians because of his position on immigration. And did horribly among African Americans.
Trump is just days away, in my estimation, of getting the nomination. The natural devolution of your party. We will be protesting outside the GOP convention this year, and we will be carrying caskets to illustrate, not as a threat, but to illustrate the death of your party, GOP.
If Trump is our nominee, they go down. The Democrats get the U.S. Senate. And again, I know that's kind of a dream scenario for folks on your side of things, but it is not healthy for the republic to become a one-party state. And that's the risk we're running.
I will agree with him. Even though me and Mr. Medved are two separate sides of the aisle, two separate sides of the spectrum, he's a conservative and I am a progressive. I do not believe that simply having progressives run everything all the time is the best idea. Single party rule is not good anywhere. There is a local politician named Don Benton. Don Benton is also a conservative. And of course, he and I don't agree either. But at his retirement party recently, one of the Democrats from, friends from the other side of the aisle stepped up and said, hey, even though he and I didn't agree on a lot of things, I was always glad that Mr. Benton was there, because Mr. Benton would ask questions. Why do we need this money? Where is it going? How's it being spent? Why do we need this tax cut? Why do we need this infrastructure project? Now, by the way, and it's natural for conservatives to simply stand in front of progress and say, stop, you are going no further. But at the same time, it's also a good idea to slow down, because we just simply cannot have runaway spending. And I know that's a two-word culture. That's a talking point. but we can't. And I believe that there is a place for conservatives, not just in society, but on the political spectrum. I don't believe in one-party rule. But here it comes, the seemingly unstoppable Trump train. And he's taking your party with it.
Yes, he's been scoring, but without goals. And in other words, he may score points, but there are no goals. What is he going to do? Nobody honestly believes he's going to build a great big gigantic wall and get Mexico to pay for it, or even that we should want to. Nobody believes that we're actually going to have a deportation force, as he's called for, and go door to door and rip people out of their homes and deport 11 million people who are residing in the United States of America. We're not talking about a game. We're not talking about sports. We're not talking about sports book or casinos. We're talking about the presidency of the United States of America. John Adams said in his famous prayer when he was the first president to come to the White House, he said, "May I pray that only wise and good men may dwell here." And for the most part, that prayer has been answered. We've had ineffective presidents, but I don't think we've ever had somebody who was in it for himself.
So there are two sides of the party right now that are struggling. And I have to say, to some degree, this is satisfying to me to see this kind of thing happening inside the party, because I have been watching and listening. I consume a little bit more progressive talk radio than I do conservative talk radio, but I really do consume quite a bit of right-wing media. Radio talk shows, television, I read the blogs, I read the right-wing websites, I see the right-wing memes going around. I consume quite a bit of that stuff, and it's because I want to know. But what I've noticed is the common thread in the whole thing is the underlying racist tones, the two-word culture, the language that they use, the dog whistle language especially. And now, the natural thing that we all expected to happen is finally happening. And it's happening out in the open. You don't simply get to go to your party and be racist and misogynistic and homophobic and use dog whistle language and just think that they're going to perpetually vote for you forever. And then when you get a candidate that gets up and says racist things, says misogynistic things, says homophobic things, you don't get to go, "That's not my party," because it is. And this is the party that the right-wing media has built. And Ted Koppel went on with Bill O'Reilly recently, and Bill says to him, how would you interview Donald Trump?
You know something, Bill, you and I have talked about this general subject many times over the years. It's irrelevant how I would do it. And you know who made it irrelevant? You did. You have changed the television landscape over the past 20 years. You took it from being objective and dull to being subjective and entertaining. And in this current climate, it doesn't matter what the interviewer asks him. Mr. Trump is going to say whatever he wants to say, it, as outrageous as it may be. And the fact of the matter is, his audience, as much as anything, is not even a television audience. It's an audience on Twitter. They deal in messages of 140 characters or less, which keeps it nice and simple.
Now, I love the fact that he said it right to his face right there. He goes, "You brought us to this point. 20 years of the kind of television that you have." But Bill O'Reilly is not alone. This same thing happens on right-wing radio. This same thing happens on right-wing blogs. It's not just Bill's fault. I was listening to NPR recently, which I rarely ever do. They're very boring. If you've listened to my show, and you are right now, you listen to the way Melvin talks, you listen to Melvin's voice. Melvin uses a lot of inflection, and Melvin throws his hands around a lot, and sometimes he bumps into the microphone, and you can hear all the keychains that are on my microphone just jingle, jangling, hangling. But on NPR, they talk like this all the time. It is now 12 after the hour. I want to thank you for being here on All Things Considered. And Melvin cannot do that. But I was listening to NPR the other day, and it was an older show, something from the archives, just popped up. And I thought it was really great because he was talking about the guy that he was talking with, the interviewer, was talking about right-wing media figures. And he says, he said something about Roger Ailes, which I found very interesting. But then he said something about Rush Limbaugh. The reason Rush Limbaugh does what he does is because he's a professional provocateur. Rush Limbaugh has been on multiple sides of any issue and has been wildly inconsistent, but it's always been because he's trying to make as much money as possible. He does not care, Rush Limbaugh does not care about the Republican Party. He's trying to be a professional provocateur, and that is so that he can charge as much money as he wants for advertising.
Rush Limbaugh always said that in interviews he's done with me and with other people, he talked about his desire to make his show provocative enough so that he could charge confiscatory advertising rates to his sponsors. And he assuredly has done that. He's made, you know, a ton of money over the years. Sean Hannity and Michael Savage and others have done well as well.
And it's worked. And it's worked quite well, much to the disadvantage, much to the chagrin of your party, Republicans. He has made, I believe his last contract was $400 million for 10 years. So he's making $40 million a year. And he doesn't give a crap about your party. He's just there riling you folks up because he wants to make him some money. And it worked. And everybody fell for it. And there were people that swear by him. I remember the first time I heard of Rush Limbaugh, I thought it was a joke. I heard about, this was the 90s, the mid-90s, and I heard about the kind of things he would say, but I was very politically ignorant. I didn't, but even then, I knew that it was crap. Something not right about that. And then I was making a delivery to a job site. And I heard one of the gentlemen had his truck door flown open, and he was listening to the radio while he worked. And I go, wow, what a crazy crap sack. What are you listening to? And he goes, this is Rush Limbaugh. And and these words actually left my mouth. Oh, that's a real person? This isn't just radio. This has gone the same for network news as well. Les Moonves was recently caught on a mic talking about how wonderful it is that the party isn't even discussing issues, that they're just hurling crap at each other because they can't make enough. They're just making tons and tons of money off people that are tuning in just because they're curious about it.
We love having all 16 Republican candidates throwing crap at each other. It's great. The more they spend, the better it is for us. And go Donald. Keep getting out there. And, this is fun. You know, watching this, let them spend money on us, and we love having them in there, and we're looking forward to a very exciting political year in 16.
To a degree, there is a little bit of satisfaction for me with respect to this, because I have been seeing this come for some time. So to be validated, to see it finally happening to the Republican Party, what I've been shouting about for the better part of 15 years, to see it finally happening now, it just seems like it's time. But also, I'm a little bit conflicted, because as I pointed out before, I don't want to see just one party rule in America, no matter what party that is. I want to hear discussion. I want to hear a discussion about ideas. Ideas about things that are good for America, that could be helpful for America, and also to point out the things that are going to be harmful to America. And I want that free exchange of ideas to happen in our newspapers and in our airwaves and on our television sets and blogs and web posts and all the rest. I want that discussion to happen. I believe very strongly in the things that I believe in. But remember, the name of the game for Limbaugh is money. The name of the game for Bill O'Reilly is money. The name of the game for most conservative media is money. And it's not just conservative media. It's CBS. And this doesn't make CBS a conservative company because they're willing to put Donald Trump all over the place. They're doing it for the money. And they say, hey, Les Moonves says, hey, I understand it's not good for America, but it's good for CBS.
Who would have thought that this circus would come to town? But, it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. That's all I got to say. So, what can I say? It's the money's rolling in, and this is fun. We had a debate a couple of weeks ago with 14 million people on a Saturday night. Amazing. That's all I can say.
Do you look at the Trump phenomenon as impacting ad spend? Because while he's got lots of money, he's got a lot of free media as well.
Yeah, he's getting a lot of free media, but all that's happening out there, there's a lot of money in the marketplace. There's a lot of money in the marketplace, and sure, as Donald, they're not even talking about issues. They're throwing bombs at each other, and I think the advertising reflects that. Most of the ads are not about issues. They're sort of like the debates. They're saying he did this or he did that. It doesn't say what I stand for. It's, it is, I've never seen anything like this, and, this is going to be a very good year for us.
They're essentially saying, to hell with the country. Who cares? Because we're making money. Who cares if we're not paying people enough money? Because it's good for us. It doesn't have to be good for them. Who cares about the media? We're making money in the media. Who cares about American discourse? Who cares about the free exchange of ideas? Who cares about what's happening out there? Because as long as we're making our money here at the very tippy top, then that is all you need, America. And that is all you need to know. Because what's good for the top 1% is good for America. And now there's an insurgency in the Republican Party. And those chickens are coming home to roost. Forget how the old saying goes. And it's at the cost of your party. You're seeing your party go by the wayside. And when Donald Trump becomes your nominee, you're going to watch your party die. Over on the Democratic side, in their debates, I'm watching them discuss ideas in their debates. And then I flip over to the Republicans. One's eating his boogers and another's talking about his wiener. That's what's become of your party. And it shouldn't be. We should, at the very least, be a two-party system in America. At the very least. And as much as I don't like the Republican Party, I don't want to see them go by the wayside. But what's happening right now will be good for them because they're going to be forced to change. Maybe the Republicans will move back to being Eisenhower Republicans. And the Democrats will move away from being corporate Democrats. And we'll all be the better for it. But mark my words, there's a lot of dummies in that party. And no matter what happens, we're going to be right back in this same place 50 years from now, talking about this same crap with politicians hurling doo-doo at each other on stage while everybody stands by and claps and makes as much money as they can. But for this year, major change is going to happen, and it's going to happen very soon. And it's about damn time. The Republican Party will be better for it. The Democratic Party will be better for it. And America will be better for it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. You can download or stream the shows at OpenSkyArchive.com, our official home, SkiwiStation.com. Like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/TFYCPO. Sorry, I'm still goofed up from doing the show here. You can listen on the go. Just download the Kiwi Station app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. The Open Sky Archive app is still available at both app stores. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. That's me. And there you can subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Hello. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with a growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail. Rejected austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Cameron for producing, and a big thanks to Kiwi Station putting us on, making us available 24/7, 365 around the world. My name is Melvin, signing off, and now that I've woken you up, good morning.